Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Manchester in November 2024. This session was all about examining the latest science and ingredients, inspiring sports and active nutrition. Your host is the Professor of Exercise and Obesity at Leeds Beckett University, Paul Gately.
We're going to hear from three speakers, which moving on to the sort of sport and active nutrition side. So this is sort of examining latest science in this area. As I say, we've got Rob Hobson, who's going to go first, followed by Sam Abbott and then Emma Fielding. So without further ado, we're going to go to Rob, who's going to talk to us about examining the science at the intersection of sport and personalised nutrition.
Hey, guys. So, yeah, what I'm talking about today is a topic that really represents the forefront of sports science, so personalised nutrition. Now, for years, athletes of all levels have focused on really broad categories to do with nutrition, so carb loading strategies, focusing on protein post-training, and staying really well hydrated. But while these principles are valid, they don't take into account the individual biology and lifestyle factors of individual athletes. So thanks to advances in technology and research, we now understand that performance and recovery are really optimized by tailored nutrition strategies for the individual athlete. So combining knowledge of genetics, gut microbiome research, biomarker analysis, and wearable technology, personalized nutrition really has the potential to kind of enhance and really transform an athlete's performance, recovery, and competition. So in the next 20 minutes, I'm really going to look at the very briefly, look at the science that underpins personalised nutrition. We're going to look at practical applications in sport in terms of this type of science, challenges and ethical considerations, so quite a few here, and then the future directions and opportunities of personalised nutrition. Right, so the science of personalised nutrition, it really rests on, I've got these three sign of pillars. So we've got nutrigenomics, we've got the gut microbiome, the role of this in metabolism and recovery, and then biomarker analysis, so real-time insights for tailored interventions for athletes. So I think while the potential is quite exciting, I think it's important to examine actually how reliable this science is, and I'll talk in a bit about sort of how practical some of it as well is in real-time use. So if we start with nutrigenomics, so this is the idea, this is the science that links genetics, nutrition, and exercise, and it's really to understand how genetic variation plays affects dietary needs and training responses. The goal is to really optimize athletic performance and recovery by tailoring strategies to an individual's genetic profile. So I think the thing is, while genetic markers are promising, there's no universally accepted individual framework for interpreting these results in real practice. So while you get results from test kits, like some of those DNA testing kits, often those results are very oversimplified. So they make them very marketable and appealing to us. But the whole thing is a lot more complicated than that. So I've picked out four genes that I think are quite relevant to sport. So and they are used to some degree in working with athletes, but there are a lot of limitations and there are other factors at play when you're working with athletes in this way. So the FTO gene, so this regulates appetite, fat metabolism and energy balance. Variants of the FTO gene, particularly those associated with the high risk of obesity, can really influence body composition and how the body stores and utilises fat. So athletes with certain variants of this FTO gene might benefit from a more balanced macronutrient profile with their strategy. So more emphasis on carbohydrates and protein and less emphasis on fat. Monitoring fat intake might also help to support body composition and performance. We've also got the CYP1A2 gene. So this is the caffeine metabolizing gene. So it determines, encodes an enzyme responsible for the metabolism of caffeine in the liver. So you can be a fast metabolizer or a slow metabolizer. Fast metabolizers benefit from enhanced focus, endurance, or reaction times with a moderate intake of caffeine. If you're a slow metabolizer, then you might get prolonged caffeine effects. So this means you really need to think about kind of when you're timing the caffeine with your athlete when you're working out their strategies. We've also got the ACTN3 gene. So this is a protein that works with fast-twitch muscle fibers. And it's really important for power and explosive movement. So if you've got the RR variant, then that's linked to strength and power activities like sprinting or weightlifting. If you've got the XX variant, then that's associated with endurance activities, and it favors really slow twitch muscle activity. So understanding this can help you determine whether an athlete might excel in power or endurance sports. Okay, so those with the XXR variant might focus on high intensity training and power-based workouts like weightlifting or sprinting. If you have the XX variant, you might prioritize endurance training. So long distance, marathon training, cycling, and the kind of thing where you really need to build your aerobic capacity. And actually coaches and sports scientists can use the identification of this gene to also help identify new talent and refine an athlete's development program. So studies have also explored the AMI1 gene. So this is quite interesting. This gene governs salivary amylase production and helps with carbohydrate digestion. So individuals with more AMI1 copies produce more salivary amylase, and this allows a faster, more efficient breakdown of starches into glucose. So athletes that have a lot more of these AMI1 copies, these can absorb and use glucose more quickly during activity and providing a steady energy source without more sort of prolonged effort. And during carbohydrate-heavy events like marathons or triathlons, they can perform better because they're more efficient at having sustained energy with their exercise from the way that their body responds. So what are the kind of broader applications? Well, I've mentioned earlier with respect to the FTO gene about changing the macronutrients, the way you work with your athletes. So that was having more carbohydrate and protein instead of fat. But there's also the potential to enhance recovery. So genes like interleukin or TNF-alpha can inform anti-inflammatory strategies because these are associated with the inflammatory response. You could offer targeted supplementation. So the VDR gene insights, so this is related to vitamin D metabolism, can help you to tailor vitamin D intakes with your athletes, you know, for stronger bones, immunity, all those things that impact on performance. And this could be really important if you work with athletes that maybe train indoors or maybe are training throughout the winter months when you really need to identify their specific vitamin D needs. So how reliable is the science? Well, even though nutrigenomics is a really promising area, I think more diverse research is really needed to translate the genetic findings that you get into something that's actionable, some actionable recommendations. Also, the genetic tests really focus on single gene variants, but you know, that really oversimplifies the traits of metabolism and performance. In reality, these traits are often polygenic, so it's lots of genes working, interactions working together. And you know, athlete success is not just based on genes and their variants, it's based on training, diet, motivation, mental health. All of these things have a significant impact regardless of what your genetic makeup is. So I think nutrigenomics was really seen as a tool and not the solution. You should combine genetic testing with other factors, lifestyle, training. And a lot of the time also you need professional guidance to turn this stuff into practical reality. I think a lot of people get their DNA results and then think it's going to be really simple to create this strategy, nutrition strategy, but it's just not easy. So next is the gut microbiome. It consists of trillions of bacteria that influence metabolism, inflammation, recovery, and overall health. For athletes, a diverse microbiome is really important, and it helps with reducing inflammation, improving recovery, and also enhancing performance. And we know that there's things you can do to your diet to improve your gut microbiome, you know, diet strategies, probiotics, prebiotics, which are available as supplements. And the ISN has guidance, the International Society for Sports Nutrition, has guidance on probiotic usage and how that can benefit sports performance in terms of gut health, improving your gut microbiota composition, immune function, strengthening your immune system so that you don't get ill when you're trying to compete and train, and nutrient absorption, really important, and also recovery. But, you know, what about the athlete's gut? Athletes have very different guts to normal non-exercisers. And that's due to, you know, to stress, to do with the type of diet they eat. They might have a healthier diet and their lifestyle. So generic probiotics may not fully address the specific needs of athletes. So personalized probiotic plans, you know, they could target individual requirements for better recovery and performance. I mean, not that we're there yet. I think, you know, it's a very complicated topic, but there's the potential. You know, there are some strains that could be useful, and some of these strains I've used myself with athletes. One is things like Saccharomyces boulardii. It's shown to help protect the gut health during travel, for example. It's shown to help with traveler's diarrhea or after antibiotic use. So if you do have an athlete that you're working with, they're training abroad or they're competing abroad, it's quite good to get them to take this to avoid any, to reduce their risk of infection when they're traveling, especially if they've gone through a phase of overreaching where they've really pushed themselves and they're slightly immunosuppressed. So another one I pulled out as well is Veillonella, a bacterium that converts lactate into propionate, which is a short-chain fatty acid that really boosts energy production. And this has been studied for its potential to help with endurance performance. You know, studies have found that elite endurance athletes have higher levels of Veillonella post-exercise compared to non-athletes. And supplementing Veillonella with mice enhance exercise capacity. So there is the potential for human application, but again, a lot of this is theoretical, it's under research is ongoing, but there's potential for these kind of things, especially around endurance sport. So the challenges with this microbiome research, you know, it's correlational, it means it observes associations without proving causation sometimes. Studies are also very widely in their methods, their population groups, dietary context. So, you know, making consistent findings can be quite challenging. So I think while targeted probiotics and emerging research hold promising for enhancing performance recovery, the current recommendations are really based on general insights. I mean, going forward, integrating microbiome insights with genetic, dietary and lifestyle data could lead to a highly sort of personalized gut health strategy. But, you know, I just don't think we're there yet with any of that stuff. So biomarker analysis. This is offers valuable insights into an athlete's physiological state in real time. It provides a foundation for personalized interventions, you know, and allows athletes to optimize their training, their nutrition, and also their recovery strategies and reduce injury risk. This can be as simple as blood tests. So there's a lot of blood testing now you can do. Even if you look at something like vitamin D and iron, you know, vitamin D is crucial for bone health, muscle function, immunity, and all of these things are key to performance and recovery. Iron, essential for oxygen transport, energy production. So deficiencies in that can lead to fatigue. And this is a really big one when you're working with female athletes in particular to do with iron deficiency. Sweat testing is common now. It analyzes sodium and electrolyte losses in your sweat. And understanding this can help you to prevent these electrolyte losses that cause dehydration. And it can help you to formulate personalized hydration strategies. So to replace these sort of fluids and electrolytes during prolonged intense activity. So glucose monitors as well are really popular. There's a lot of people walking around with the yellow glucose monitor on, good old Zoe. You know, these can monitor real blood sugar fluctuations, and understanding how your blood sugar is patterns are occurring to athletes can help them to time their carbohydrate intake more effectively for sustained energy during competition. So how do athletes really use this data? Well, it can be used, as I said before, to tailor dietary strategies. So adjusting micronutrient ratios or supplementing with specific nutrients if you're shown to have a deficiency. It could be used to optimize recovery. So issues like inflammation, you could get tested for elevated CRP. You've got nutrient deficiencies. Then these can all enable targeted interventions with anti-inflammatory foods, supplements, and adjusted training plans. It can also help with performance enhancement. So you can fine tune your nutrition strategy and your hydration strategy to improve performance. And obviously injury prevention as well. You know, if you've got low calcium and low iron, then you're more at risk of stress fractures, fatigue, or overtraining injuries. So how reliable is the science? Well, biomarker science is really well established, both clinical and a sports context, and there's a lot of research to back it up. The effectiveness does depend on expert interpretation of the results. Not everybody knows how to read those test results that they get from their blood analysis. And it can lead to actionable insights, but these only work best when they're integrated with other assessments of diet, training, training loads and recovery. I think in practice, a lot of this stuff is no longer limited to professional athletes. You know, you all have access to blood testing, glucose monitors, you know, watches that test your heart rate, all that kind of stuff. So now we do have this information. I think it's much more available to recreational athletes and you know, just people trying to keep fit, wanting to improve their performance and well-being. So I think, are we there yet? Nutrigenomics, it provides valuable insights, but it's not definitive. Microbiome research shows exciting potential, but it's still evolving. And biomarker analysis, that really offers the most practical and actionable insights that we have at the moment. Like I said, testing for deficiencies and levels of certain other markers in your blood. So practical applications. Well, the science of personalized nutrition is still evolving, but I think several strategies are already showing promise. You know, carbohydrate strategies. Carbs are essential for athletic performance, but not all athletes respond in the same way to, say, carb loading strategies. You know, to optimize performance, you have to think about your glycogen storage, and you might even want to think about genetic variants of genes, like the AMPD1 gene. You know, naturally, athletes with naturally high storage, glycogen storage capacity, can manage traditional carbohydrate loading strategies that can have you, you know, taking as high as 12 grams per kilogram of body weight a day. Whereas athletes with lower glycogen storage may need more moderate interventions with a gradual approach, so a little and often carb strategy to do to avoid any discomfort with their and maximize their glycogen stores. I guess now with genetic factors like variations in this AMPD1 gene, you can influence how carbohydrates are metabolized. So this gene impacts energy regeneration during high-intensity short bursts of energy, so it's particularly relevant for power-based athletes like sprinters or weightlifters. These athletes might not benefit much from exercise excessive carb loading and instead require these moderate adjustments to align with their unique energy metabolism. So tailoring carbohydrate intake with glycogen storage and potentially this genetic profiling with those genes may enhance their performance. It means that endurance athletes can thrive on higher carbohydrate loads combined with a tapering phase to maximize their glycogen storage. But power-based athletes with these AMPD1 variants will benefit from a more moderate intake, strategically timed to meet the demands of their sport. So hydration plans. Well, staying hydrated is really key to performance and recovery. And athletes vary in how much they sweat and how much sodium they lose and other electrolytes in their sweat. So generic plans don't always work for every athlete. Studies have shown that personalized hydration plans tailored to the individual sweat rate and sodium losses really improve performance metrics and recovery outcomes. So, you know, athletes adhering to these plans show measurable benefits like greater anaerobic power, improved cognitive focus, and also quicker heart rate recovery. So how do you really transfer this into a personal strategy? Well, understanding your sweat electrolyte losses from testing means you can tailor your electrolyte solutions based on sweat concentrations rather than relying on generic solutions that are ready made that might not be as effective. Personal hydration plans also consider environmental factors like heat and humidity and exercise duration, you know, to maintain hydration and electrolyte balance through training and competition. So sweat testing is a really established tool and it is really useful. I've used it myself with athletes to try and refine their hydration strategy. But it still really depends on accurate data collection. It depends on adherence to the plan by your athlete. And it also depends on external factors like diet and training intensity. So like all this stuff, it doesn't stand alone. It has to be used in the context of other things to get the most out of it. So what about health tech in personalized sports nutrition? Well, wearables and microbiome testing are making personalized nutrition much more accessible for everybody. These tools help athletes to make real-time adjustments to their diet, to their recovery, their performance strategies, and their overall individual needs. You know, athletes, examples of Whoop or Garmin, you know, I think some of you are probably wearing some of these bits of kit. These track your heart rate variability, your sleep quality, your calorie expenditure, and lots of other things. You know, you can monitor recovery readiness, training stress, and overall performance. You know, you can adjust your training intensity. You can focus on your sleep if you're not getting enough sleep or adequate quality of sleep. You can change your nutrition by fine-tuning your calorie and macronutrient intake to adjust for your energy expenditure and recovery needs. You know, in the future, I think advanced algorithms could combine lots of different data like sleep quality with dark history or workout intensity. And, you know, it could get to the point where with this technology, if you get the algorithms right, you know, poor sleep data might suggest that you need to increase your carbohydrate intake to replace glycogen that you haven't managed to do overnight. So there's a potential here for quite exciting stuff to happen. But again, there are challenges with this. You know, in terms of the improving the accuracy and usability of the technology, you know, complex metrics can be really hard to understand without guidance, like I said, with the genetic stuff. And translating data into actional strategies, it still requires professional coaches, you know, registered sports nutritionists and dietitians to help you to fully optimize that. So microbiome testing, well, services like Zoe, they offer you insights into your gut bacteria, your blood sugar responses, and your blood fat levels. The goal is to optimize health, energy, and metabolic function, but their current focus is really general. Direct applications for athletic performance and sport are really just still emerging. You know, the microbiome testing offers general recommendations like increasing your fiber intake or adding probiotics to your diet to reduce inflammation and improve your gut health. So, but they're not really tailored for this sort of athletic platform. You know, athletes might use these insights to diversify their own microbiome with prebiotic or probiotic rich foods. And they might use, but any changes related to sports nutrition will still rely on the expert advice, emerging research from experts to feed into that. And also, you know, the current testing really lacks the sort of direct actionable athlete specific insights. So what's some of the challenges? Well, there are challenges around accessibility. You know, it's still quite a lot of money. Even if you buy Zoe, that's still quite an outlay for a lot of athletes. Data overload. You know, this stuff churns out a lot of data and then athletes could struggle. The coaches could struggle to interpret that data and that could lead to risks in overtraining or unbalanced diets. Ethical considerations. How is that going to be used? Is that going to be discriminated against you with certain sports? And then really future directions. You know, we need to think about sustainability and nutrition. This is a really important factor. The growing interest in environmental impact through sustainable practices. Gen Z is really leading the way with this. You know, carbon footprint tracking, investigating how plant-based diets can meet the protein and calorie needs of athletes that need, that want to go, that need a lot of energy and a lot of protein. We need more research on women. We need to understand that diverse group and not just research on women, but sort of across the board of women through different stages of life. We need to look at non-binary data as well from athletes so we can really truly personalize a lot of this stuff. So, and finally, also AI. I think AI is going to come to it. You can't have this conversation without sort of nodding to AI. And I think that will bring sort of genetic testing, microbiome profiling, biomarkers, all of that stuff, it will bring it together. You know, algorithms will be able to forecast this stuff in real time, looking at that. But, you know, again, that AI effectiveness really depends on the quality of the data, the diversity of the training data that's used to manage it. And their accuracy isn't perfect. You know, it still needs human expertise to double check the results. And also, it doesn't account for nuanced factors like illness or hormone imbalances that could also play a role in this. So, yeah, I can finish.
Thanks very much, Rob. We're gonna leave it. We're going to hear from our other two speakers and then we'll go to a Q&A. So next up is Sam Abbott, who is a PhD student at Nottingham Trent and a performance nutritionist at Loughborough Sport.
Hello, everyone. As Paul has just said, my name's Sam. I'm a PhD student at Nottingham Trent University. And my research focuses on trying to optimise female athlete sort of health and performance, primarily through using nutritional interventions which target the gut. And alongside this, I also work as a performance nutritionist at Loughborough Sport. And today I'm kind of talking about some of the ways in which we can optimise performance nutrition for female athletes and some of the considerations we need to make when working with people in the space and some of the sort of practical things we might need to consider. So currently there's a big rise in both the participation and professionalism of women's sport. But the research is kind of lagging behind quite a bit. So this is a recent study which has audited sports nutrition research, looking at participants of males and females and across various sort of different themes within sports nutrition. And in the majority of these themes, females are accounting for 11 to 23% of participants, so other than this medical supplements theme. And within those female sort of studies that have looked at females, the majority of these have not accounted properly for menstrual cycle phase. So again, this question is sort of the rigor potentially of these studies and then the applicability of these to female athletes. And the reason I bring this up is when you look at the research, the majority of it has been done in men. And this means the majority of sort of guidelines around sports nutrition are based on research which has been done in men. And we've copied and pasted that and we've gone, okay, this will be fine for women as well, which isn't necessarily the case. So there's a lot of room for future research within this space. That's kind of just setting up that we don't know very much. It's going to be the theme of this presentation. And why is there such a big research gap? The bottom line is women are a lot more complicated than men, particularly when it comes to the research. So if you think about sort of your average woman, firstly, a lot of women will experience a menstrual cycle, but that doesn't necessarily, that's not as simple as it seems. So even a regularly menstruating woman will have a range of menstrual cycle sort of length, potentially from 21 to 35 days in a regular cycle. You may also have a menstrual irregularity, so you might have really long menstrual cycles or not at all. You might look like you have a normal menstrual cycle, but you're anovulatory, so you don't have that normal sort of spike in hormones. You might also have different sort of menstrual-related dysfunctions, like endometriosis, PCOS. Then you move on to the looking at sort of hormonal contraceptives, and there's hundreds of different hormonal contraceptives to think about. Also got pregnancy to think about. Postpartum women, HRT, people going through perimenopause, menopause. So there's so many different sort of subcategories of women. So then when you try and research within women, there's a lot of things to consider, which makes it hard and means there isn't very much research out there. But we do know some things and we can recommend some things to female athletes. And this is kind of what I'm going to talk a bit about today. So some of the key pillars that I think are really important when working with a female to consider. So going to look a bit at energy availability, meeting carbohydrate requirements, a few key micronutrients, as well as discussing some practical considerations and whether we know enough to sort of try and tailor nutrition around the menstrual cycle. So firstly, when looking at energy availability, so this is essentially energy intake, so what we eat, take away exercise energy expenditure, so calories we burn through exercise over our fat-free mass. And this should be the primary consideration when working with female athletes. So before we get into the really sexy stuff and playing with like different supplements, we need to make sure they're eating enough calories to sustain the exercise that they're doing. And this can kind of be broadly categorized into different sort of energy availability. So you can have optimal energy availability and you can do this calculation, you can work it out. And this is above 45 calories per kilogram of fat-free mass per day. And then you've also got reduced and low energy availability. And when these sort of, when people are experiencing these, this can lead to various different health issues. And the reason I talk about this in women is a lot of women, sort of particularly in the female athletes field, seem to have problems or experience low energy availability. So I'm going to briefly talk about this study. It's a 2020 study with elite female footballers, so WSL players. And they looked at, over a five-day period, looked at the energy availability of these players. And they found that the majority of the team, so 62% were in a state of reduced energy availability, and 23% were in a state of low energy availability. So only 15% of these elite sportswomen were in a state of optimal energy availability. So this leads to potential, sort of, firstly, health consequences, but also potential performance implications as well. And when we sort of enter into a state of chronic low energy availability, this sort of leads to potential for a condition called REDS, so relative energy deficiency in sport. And this is sort of a syndrome characterized by physiological and also psychological sort of impacts from a state of low energy availability. And this can lead to things like greater risk of injury, illness, loss of menstrual cycle, so sort of that reproductive function aspect, increased stress, anxiety, and a whole wealth of potential health issues, as well as performance sort of effects. And this tends to be more prevalent in female athletes. And also female athletes may be slightly less resilient to the effects of low energy availability, partly because of the high sort of energetic cost of the reproductive cycle. So managing those changes and fluctuations in hormones means that when athletes are in a state of low energy availability, female athletes tend to be more likely to have negative sort of effects, so potentially more likely to pick up things like illnesses and stress fractures. And there's some sort of real world examples of some of the dangers around sort of female athletes and low energy availability. So this is a British athlete who at only 18 years old was diagnosed with osteoporosis, predominantly sort of diagnosed as being due to having red. So it's a real issue within the female athlete field and kind of the first thing as nutritionists, practitioners, that we should be aiming for females to meet. And then sort of moving on, carbohydrate requirements. So most of you will probably already know this, but carbohydrates predominantly are important as an energy source. So we need that to fuel exercise, then also potentially to help with sort of immunity and helping with that athlete availability side of things. And then also thinking, decision-making, which again, important within sport. And these are the current guidelines around how much carbohydrate athletes should be consuming depending on their activity levels. And as I sort of alluded to at the start, all these guidelines are based on studies which have been done in men. There's no sort of categorical evidence to suggest that these aren't applicable to women, but there's not necessarily any evidence to suggest these are definitely what women should be achieving. But if we just kind of consider some of the practical considerations around consuming these amounts of carbohydrates, if we, for example, took a 60 kilogram endurance runner and asked them to eat 8 grams per kilogram a day of carbohydrate, this is around 480 grams of carbohydrate. And if you think about this in food terms, it is a lot of food, and this can be a struggle to meet. We're talking 3 big meals a day and lots of snacks to meet these sort of carbohydrate guidelines, which women can, well, men as well, but can struggle to achieve. And generally, sort of the research has suggested that females do struggle to meet these carbohydrate guidelines, and also potentially aren't adapting their carbohydrate intake to their training load. And again, we've got another study in female footballers who haven't necessarily proved themselves to be the best in terms of energy intake. But this study, there's a few studies that have looked at carbohydrate intake in elite female footballers. And sort of one study showed they're eating 3.3 grams per day, and one study showed they're having 4.1 grams per day of carbohydrates, which puts them in the sort of light activity sort of section of carbohydrate guidelines. There's a few issues with how sort of you calculate or collect data around food intake, but the bottom line is they probably aren't meeting their carbohydrate intakes. And this is a real problem within female athletes. And some of the potential reasons, firstly, just difficulty to eat that amount of carbs. But there is also potential issues around sort of fear of putting on weight and fear of sort of body composition testing, and also just a lack of knowledge of why carbs are important. You hear messaging like no carbs before marbs and stuff like that, which it's not necessarily the best thing for athletes when they need to sort of be eating these carbs as a sort of fuel source. And these quotes are from elite female footballers suggesting they don't want to eat carbs because it might make you fat, even though these are at the highest level of sport. Or I don't like eating carbs, that's not something I do. So potentially not understanding the benefits of carbs to their performance. So again, something to really focus on when working with females. I'm going to move on sort of swiftly throughout to touch on a couple micronutrients in particular within females. So the one of the sort of ones that's normally brought up when you discuss micronutrients in females is iron. So around 35% of female athletes are estimated to be deficient in iron. And this is compared to 5% of the population and around 3 times more than male athletes. So it seems to be a real problem in particular in this population. And this is a problem because iron is important for sort of this oxygen carrying. So it can lead to issues with fatigue and low energy in athletes. And one of the reasons it's difficult for female athletes is due to sort of menstruation, you're having this iron loss every sort of month when you're premenopausal. So the iron sort of RDAs for teenagers and premenopausal women is about 10 milligrams higher than it is for men or sort of older women. So it can be really hard for female athletes to meet these guidelines, and they might not necessarily be aware of the sort of increased RDAs for their sort of for females. And also within female athletes in particular, during exercise, you can have something called exercise-induced iron loss. So particularly with sort of endurance runners, it's called foot strike hemolysis. So essentially when your foot hits the floor during running, you're losing tiny amounts of iron. So this again can lead to sort of increased levels of iron deficiency in females. There's no specific athlete targeted guidelines, but the general recommendations is probably athletes might need 1 to 2 milligrams more iron than the general population. And generally when we're working with female athletes, it's recommended that they are tested, had blood tests for iron sort of every 6 months. Calcium again, really important within female athletes. So bone stress fractures more common in female athletes than male athletes, partly potentially due to reduced bone size and density, and also potentially maybe sort of lower energy intake. But this very small graph shows bone mineral density in females versus males. So males is the green bit on top. Generally, males have higher bone mineral density. But if you can see, there's a big drop off in calcium as well. In bone mineral density around menopause. And this is due to sort of estrogen's effect on, partly due to estrogen's effect on calcium absorption and retention in the bone. So potentially sort of master's level athletes, sort of female athletes who are sort of postmenopausal may need more calcium, but also potentially amenorrheic athletes. And there is a large sort of cohort of amenorrheic athletes. Obviously that's a whole sort of problem in itself, but if you are working with an amenorrheic athlete, they will also have reduced estrogen, so potentially may need higher levels of calcium. They're also obviously more likely to sustain a stress fracture, potentially partly due to this calcium and partly this low energy availability. And then sort of in conjunction, often talk about vitamin D when we talk about calcium. So vitamin D helps the body absorb calcium and sort of plays this role in bone health, but also plays roles in sort of helping immunity and muscle sort of function as well. And again, really high levels of female athletes are deficient in vitamin D. And sort of one of the reasons for this is the only kind of source, you can only get around 10% of your vitamin D from the diet. So a lot of your vitamin D needs to come from the sun. We live in England. There's not very much of that, particularly within the winter months. So again, this is sort of, the government do tend to recommend that everyone throughout the winter months should be supplementing with vitamin D, sort of athlete or not. And again, sort of as Rob alluded to earlier, the screening for these biomarkers is particularly important where sort of resources allow within these populations. So to just sort of summarise what I've talked through earlier in a bit of a pyramid of importance, so energy availability should be the first thing we think about when we work with female athletes. Then we need to think about macronutrients, so carbs, but also fat and protein. Particularly micronutrients that might be of importance to female athletes. Then we might get onto nutrient timing. So when should athletes be eating carbs, fat, protein around exercise and how to sort of manipulate that. And then sort of we might then think about individualization and how can we adapt different nutrition strategies for the individual. And when we talk about individualization, people sort of like to think about nutrition and the menstrual cycle. If you quickly went onto Instagram and looked at nutrition for the menstrual cycle, you'd be told exactly what foods you should eat at every single day of the menstrual cycle and which days to do yoga and which days to go to the gym and do a hard training session, which isn't necessarily the case when you sort of delve into it slightly more. So there have been a few studies which suggested that potentially you may have greater levels of carbohydrate absorption oxidization in the follicular phase of your menstrual cycle, and potentially you might have greater levels of fat oxidation in the luteal phase of your menstrual cycle. So maybe you should adapt what you eat around your menstrual cycle and the exercise you're doing. But kind of the bottom line is around all of this menstrual cycle sort of research so far is the findings are inconsistent, and nobody's really decided whether or not these things are real, and if they are real, or if they are sort of shown to have an effect, does that actually influence performance, and should you be changing what you do for each day of the cycle? And this isn't me saying that I don't think nutrition has any sort of thing to play in the menstrual cycle, but I think potentially on a more individual sort of level, it may have some influence. So the menstrual cycle can influence nutritional behaviours of athletes. So athletes might experience cravings at different times of the menstrual cycle. Athletes have generally been shown to consume slightly greater calories during their luteal phase, so that second half of the cycle. So it can influence nutrition in those ways, may influence an athlete's mood. And again, that could influence their nutritional behaviours at certain times of the cycle. May also affect what symptoms they're experiencing. So one big one in particular, and sort of my area of research, but GI symptoms can be a real issue for female athletes, particularly sort of around their period. And this may influence the things that they want to consume and the things, and maybe sort of have an influence on nutrition in that way. And then also it's really helpful as a warning sign for nutritional issues. So potentially if someone has a loss of a menstrual cycle or change in the sort of length of the menstrual cycle, that could be an indicator of something that needs to be done to improve their nutrition. And just to hone in on menstrual symptoms for a little bit, so around 77% of female athletes experience negative menstrual symptoms during their menstrual cycle. So sort of some of the top ones are bloating, increased gas, period cramps, changes in appetite, disturbed sleep. So all of these things could potentially affect an athlete's performance and their sort of nutritional behaviours as well. And the majority of these symptoms occur in the first 1 to 2 days of menstruation, so when an athlete's on their period, and also the week before. So this study looked at menstrual symptoms throughout the cycle, so in early follicular phase, ovulation, and mid-luteal phase. And generally, athletes were experiencing greater frequency and severity of symptoms around this early follicular phase, so when they're on their period. So potentially, when we're looking at nutrition, it might be something that we can work with athletes to help alleviate these symptoms through maybe reducing fiber or helping sort of with their carbohydrate intake around exercise. So this is sort of leads me to my sort of main point around, yes, nutrition does influence the menstrual cycle, but maybe not on something we can sort of apply to everyone, but more treating the individual as the sort of main important thing. And some ways in which this we can sort of help do this with athletes is potentially menstrual cycle tracking. So helping athletes be more aware of their symptoms, potentially the impacts of these symptoms on their exercise, as well as note any changes to their cycle. So lack of menstrual cycle changes in their length. And it's important that they track sort of in addition to when they're bleeding, but also these symptoms and how it makes them feel. So to conclude, there's not really enough evidence to suggest that we should be changing diet according to the menstrual cycle, but we should be focusing on helping athletes optimize their daily nutrition. So that adequate energy intake, ensuring they're meeting their carbohydrate and other macronutrient guidelines, being aware of really common micronutrient deficiencies in female athletes, and then also potentially using menstrual cycle tracking to enable that individualization of nutrition for our athletes. Thank you.
Brilliant, Sam. And on time too, well done. Fantastic. So moving on to our third speaker, Emmett Fielding, who's gonna, I think this is a great title actually, From Beige to Brilliant, and Evaluating Clean Nutrition with Colour.
Yeah, so this is quite a different approach and look at food and drink. Whilst we can focus on the inside of the food and drink, we also want to look at the external and how that is going to help your product stand out, especially if we're keeping it clean label. So I'm Emma Fielding, I work at G&T, and we're all about plant-based colours, so colours from fruits and vegetables and edible plants, so things like carrots, pumpkin, beetroot, etc. You'll see more of that. So first we're going to look at the power of colour, so how it actually influences us every day, then how it affects different trends in food and drink, and also what those trends are in color, and then how you can achieve this using our clean label expiry products. First, looking at the power of color. Color influences us by showing us how to navigate situations. So if we think in Western cultures, wearing a white dress shows your intent and role in that situation. The traffic light, it's almost subconscious, you know, green go, red stop, which has then also been translated to food and drink packaging. And even in crisps, you know which color links to which flavor. And they've done tests, I don't know if you've seen it on Instagram or whatever, where they put salt and vinegar crisps in the red bag, and then everyone said, no, that's salted, because how important the color is influencing us. So it can also evoke our mood and emotion. So if we see there, they use orange and brighter colors in lecture halls to keep people alert and awake. So there's a bit of orange in these lights here. So hopefully that's working. And then if you've seen the Inside Out films, they depict sadness with this blue character to show, you know, it's a lower mood using blue. Taylor Swift's latest album, The Tortured Poets Department, she uses this black and white imagery to really, it's more storytelling, it's less sort of pop and fun. Or if you went to the Eras Tour, if you chose different colors to match her albums and which really fit with your emotions as well. It can also signal our identity, so whether we're part of sports teams, a rebellious sort of green brat summer that we maybe had, our fashion choices, or we all know from Mean Girls, on Wednesdays we wear pink, or Tuesdays we wear green. So this really signals that they're together and they're a team and a clique, and you by using color. But how does this then affect trends in food and drink? So whether you have noticed it or not, many brands and products use color in their branding, but also in their actual product identifying as well over things like flavor. So it can be, if we look at blue maybe has less flavor association. So it's really all about that experience. So you see there, Starbucks really shouting about the fact that this is a blue frappuccino. You're enticed to try it. You don't know what you're going to get. Or Blue Kazade down there at the bottom. Or using things like blue for winter and pink for summer, so linking it also to seasonality. Then it can also be used in color coding. So if we look at smoothies especially, they have different colors for different functionalities. Green naturally has that health halo linked to superfoods. You could also have yellow for immunity. So using the color over the flavor. Also with Ella's Kitchen, they use different color shades for their different pouches. So maybe your kid likes the orange one the best. And also the green goodness dip there. So highlighting the flavors that you also maybe associate with green. It can also kind of tap into our playfulness or nostalgia. So things like rainbow, unicorn really fit in this area as well. It's not a flavor. It's all about the color, the fun. So things rainbow sports nutrition there, and then also down here the daily aminos are rainbow sherbet, and then finally this pink mayo, I think that was in the Barbie time. So all about just sort of that sense of experimenting using color. And don't just take it from me, we also spoke to Professor Charles Pence, who works at Oxford University, and he was saying how color really is definitely influenced by social media. It's something you want to share online. If we see things like rosé wine or Aperol, definitely in the summer times, I saw this on my feed, people cheersing with the Aperol because it has this vibrant, attractive color shade. So what color trends are we actually seeing in food and drink? So when we did our research and deep dive into color and shifting consumer behavior as well, this generation have really grown up with climate change at the forefront. So looking at practices that are helping the planet be better for future generations, so putting back, so kind of that next step up from sustainability. Then looking at community joy, so coming together to make meaningful change, keeping practices from local communities and how we can implement these. And then finally, going slow. So slowing down, having less impact lifestyles, healing ourselves to heal the earth. Also Generation Z, they're drinking less and using more adaptogenic and functional ingredients. So then we drove to a new palette of colors. So the first one is Elevated Earth. And as you can see already, this is quite dark, rich, deep colour shades. And this is all about looking at nature and celebrating its imperfections. So looking at those, yeah, richer colour shades, a bit more murkier, really celebrating the heritage ingredients, connecting directly to the source. We see more savoury and umami notes coming through, also from mushrooms, whether that's from flavour or functionality. And it really gives food and drink this organic, but premium look and feel. And here are some of the colour suggestions. So rich sort of yellow shades, and then also browns and pinks and purples. And here, using our plant-based colours, we've created some BCAA drinks. So they fit because, yeah, they have maybe a vegetable element in there for the flavour, so it's less sweet. And it's also using these deeper colour shades. So the far left one, the yellow, that's using our safflower product. Then the purple and the red, that uses a combination of spirulina, so already has a good health association, and then topped up with our black carrot, but in different ratios. So the violet is more spirulina than with black carrot to take it more to a reddish tone, and then vice versa. So the purpley color, it was more red, and then we added the spirulina to take it more blue. And also with these colors, you can label them as things like carrot concentrate or spirulina concentrate, and you can use a positive front of pack communication. So rather than saying no artificial colors or no artificial flavors, what's not in the product, actually telling the consumer what is in the product, and that's very easy to understand as well. So colors from fruits, vegetable, and plants. So Elevated Earth, this is all about the deep, dark, rich colour shades from nature celebrating its authenticity. So it's quite safe colours, but very reassuring to the consumer. So here also we have some other examples, not just in sports nutrition, because of course we're all consumers at the end of the day. Then the second colour direction is Nature Lab. So this is all about celebrating the vibrancy of nature. If we picture a healthy garden, you're not just picturing green grass, you're picturing vibrant flowers, berries, and different colours. So it's all about that, yeah, that bright, out-of-this-world colour shades. We've already seen a bit from spirulina, and all our colours are from fruits and vegetables and plants. So you can get this vibrancy. And not just are we inspired by the vibrancy of nature, but also the exotic fruits and vegetable flavors, and also the textures and patterns. So if you cut open a kiwi, it has that repeating pattern. And how can this then inspire product development? Maybe less so in beverages. So it's all about that real bright kaleidoscope of color shades. So as you can see there in the bottom, really vibrant, loud, pinks and bright blues that are bringing this colour direction to life. So here again, we brought it to life using our Xberry colours in a geometric functional gummy. So this fits in this colour direction because they're all different shapes, very intriguing, two-toned, and we compare them with exotic flavours like bergamot, prickly pear, and dragon fruit. And yeah, here we use a mixture of things like our red potato, again, the spirulina for the blue, and turmeric for the yellow. So Nature Lab was all about the bold, the bright, out of this world colour shades, celebrating nature in terms of the colours, the flavours, and also the textures and patterns that we see. Again, we've shown some different examples. So snacks, this ice cream coating here with different sugar crystals to create those unique textures and patterns, all in these vibrant colour shades. Then third and finally is wholesome nostalgia. So nostalgia is definitely a trend we see across all categories, not just food and drink. If you've noticed maybe the 90s fashion coming back in, or we've seen things like old TV shows returning, like Big Brother and Gladiator, there's a real sense of desire for nostalgic things, especially with ongoing cost of living stresses. We just want that sense of comfort. So wholesome nostalgia in terms of colors, it's all about those feel-good rituals. Whilst the other two were celebrating different aspects of nature, this is really going back to the nature of oneself. So using these pastel color shades to create this sort of comforting feeling. And whether that's in terms of nostalgic flavors, also inspired from things like confectionery, so sweets from our childhood, or bakery goods, so your grandma's apple pie or whatever. It's all fitting within this color direction. And not only those types of flavors, but we also see, as you can see from the imagery, a lot of floral flavors coming through here. Because like things like chamomile and lavender, they naturally give you that calming sense and also that sense of comfort. So this is then all paired with nice pastel soothing color shades, as you see there at the bottom. So here we've put our colors in a whey protein base. So yeah, you can actually see the powder as well. And naturally this gives a nice white background, which then gives also a nice pastel color shade. So these are, sentimental supercharge, as I call them. So it's all about, and they connect because they are in the pastel soothing color shades, but also connected to nostalgic flavors like peach pie, red velvet, and bubblegum. The first two use our beetroot and safflower combination, again in different ratios. So the first one is more yellow from the safflower, and then we've topped it up with our beetroot color to give it more that peachy tone. And then the second one is more of the beetroot to give it the pink shade, but then a little bit of yellow to take it more to a reddish shade. And then finally, as mentioned earlier, the blue is from our spirulina-based X-ray product. So Wholesome Nostalgia was all about the feel-good, soft, soothing pastel shades paired with floral flavors and also nostalgic classic flavors from your childhood. So the three color directions I've just shown, first we had Elevated Earth, which was all about the richness, the deep imperfections of nature, those deep textures, giving food and drink an organic but premium look and feel. Then we had Nature Lab, so celebrating all the out of this world color shades, the vibrancy. So nature or natural doesn't have to be dull and muted and boring. It can be very vibrant, very playful, bright, and also paired with intriguing textures and flavor, exotic flavors. And then finally, as just shown, it was Wholesome Nostalgia. So this is all about the soft pastel color shades, soothing, and feel good rituals as well. So we're using Xperia, you can create these vibrant color shades. There's definitely a demand for a consumer for a cleaner label. We've also seen in the US and California, they're now for 2028 having the removal of those of 6 azo dyes in schools. So the consumer is shifting this behavior, and that's why using Xperia, you can get these clean label color shades. So not just in sports nutrition, but in a wide variety of food and drink. And as mentioned, because it's from fruits and vegetables and edible plants, it doesn't have to be dull or muted or toned down. You can really achieve a vibrant spectrum of color shades.
Brilliant, Emma. Thank you very much. So perfect. So questions? From the audience?
In the first graph that you showed us, Sam, there was this abnormality almost on the medical supplement for women. Suddenly there were more research on women. Why was that?
Yeah, so that was looking at a lot of things like iron and vitamin D. I think it's just in that world, maybe the awareness that is sort of a lot of women experience deficiencies in that. So they've kind of looked at that and paired it with sport. But that is an abnormality with that. But I think it's mainly because women potentially are more likely to be deficient in those things.
Brilliant. We're going to, in the interest of time, so we can all be on in our all leaving by 5 and miss the Manchester traffic, we're going to finish that session there. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. We've got some exciting news to share about more live events this year. We're heading to Manchester in May, Ascot in October, and Dublin in November. And for the first time, we're hosting an event in mainland Europe. In September 2025, we'll be in Rotterdam. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com. And we look forward to seeing you there.